Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're jumping into the story of a name that, well, for a lot of people, it instantly brings up images of pure luxury, incredible speed, and, let's be honest, James Bond.
Absolutely. We're talking Aston Martin.
Exactly. We're diving deep into the legend that is Aston Martin. So our mission today, really, is to unpack this fascinating story. It's often been pretty turbulent, hasn't it? But ultimately, it's a triumphant one.
Definitely.
How did this company, founded way back in 1913, managed to navigate, you know, two world wars, countless financial crises, changing hands so many times.
It's quite the saga.
And still emerge as this global luxury powerhouse.
Mm.
We want to look at the iconic models, that unforgettable link to Bond, and figure out what makes these cars just so sought after.
It really is a testament to vision and just sheer resilience, isn't it? That's a theme you see again and again. And we're drawing all this from a really rich source that details Aston Martin's whole journey, right up to the most popular models now in 2025. So this deep dive should give you a pretty comprehensive look.
Okay, let's get into it then, starting right at the beginning. Aston Martin's founding vision, it seems, came from a real passion for racing. It was 1913. Lionel Martin, who apparently raced a lot at Aston Hills, teamed up with Robert Bamford. Their goal was simple: build their own cars.
And the name, it's literally Aston Hills plus Martin.
Right. And what's interesting about their very first car is how it came together. It used a Coventry simplex engine, four-cylinder, and a chassis from an old 1908 Isotta Fraschini. Quite a mix.
It really was. But, you know, what's kind of illuminating is how quickly those ambitions almost got completely derailed.
Yeah.
Production was just starting, and then boom, World War I. It just immediately stopped everything. Yeah. All their machinery, everything they needed had to be sold to the government for making warplanes.
Wow. Talk about a pivot.
Exactly. And then after the war, Bamford left in 1920. Martin was left scrambling for funds. They had a little moment, entered the French Grand Prix in 22, but nope, bankruptcy by 1924.
So this early turbulence, it wasn't just bad luck then.
No, I think it shows how vulnerable these new ventures were, you know?
Right.
External shocks, the difficulty of just getting established. Even when new buyers came in, renamed it Aston Martin Motors later that year. It failed again just a year later, 1925.
Good grief.
By 1926, the factory's closed, and Lionel Martin, the co-founder, is out, gone from the company he started. It really shows how shaky things were, and yet, the name survived.
That's the amazing part. How did it keep coming back?
Yeah.
Our source mentions, despite this poor fortune, the new owners, Bill Renwick and Augustus Bertelli, just wouldn't quit.
That's right. They showed this almost stubborn determination. Kept working at it.
But it wasn't smooth sailing yet.
Not at all. The 30s. More money problems, more leadership changes. Elpido Brune, then Arthur Sutherland. Sutherland actually started mass production for road cars.
Okay, some progress.
Yeah, but then history repeats.
Hmm.
World War II hits, car production stops completely again, setting them up for more financial pain right after the war. It just highlights that resilience, doesn't it? It seems almost baked into the company's DNA, just refusing to stay down.
It really does feel like a brand that couldn't catch a break. Which brings us, thankfully, to a real turning point. The David Brown era.
Ah, yes, 1947.
David Brown takes over, an industrialist, passionate about engineering, and he really seems to be the one who transformed Aston Martin into the luxury icon we know. What did he do differently?
Well, Brown wasn't just another investor. He had industrial know-how, a long-term plan. He understood luxury needed stability and a strong identity. He was so influential, his initials, DD, became the prefix for their main series.
Right, the DB series.
And that continues today. Think of the DB5, the Bond car. That's David Brown.
So the 50s saw the DB series launched formally.
Yep, 1950. Models like the DB Mark II, the DB 24x58. This really helped build their reputation first in the UK, quality, performance.
Yes, and building that reputation then led to global stardom.
Pretty much. The 1963 DB5, that luxury grand tourer, you know, powerful, comfy for long drives, that cemented their place.
But let's be real, it was Goldfinger, right?
Yeah,
1964
yeah.
Sean Connery.
Oh, absolutely. That film appearance took them international. Mainstream fame. It became the Bond car. Incredible how pop culture can just elevate a brand like that.
Totally transformative. But, oh, even that didn't solve everything.
Nope. Another speed bump, as our source puts it, 1972, sold again to Company Developments.
Yeah.
Ran up nearly £1 million in debt, led to another sale. It just shows, you know, even with an amazing product, you need solid management. It's always that balance act, isn't it? Desirability versus, well, keeping the lights on.
It does. Which leads to a key turnaround in the mid-70s. This time, they managed a more strategic recovery.
Right. Big recruitment drive and a deliberate shift in the product line, modernizing.
Moving away from just grand tours.
Exactly, towards cars like the V8 Vantage in 77 and the convertible Volante in 78.
And that V8 Vantage, what was the big deal there?
That shift was crucial. The V8 Vantage, often called Britain's first supercar, it was a bold move.
Showed they could do raw power too.
Precisely, not just elegance. It apparently outperformed the Ferrari Daytona, top speed 170 mile per hour. The Volante, the convertible, brought in the appeal too. Vital adaptation heading into the 80s, which was a rough time economically.
Speaking of the 80s, our source mentions plans for new cars after buying MG, the British maker.
Yeah, but those plans fell through. Just shows the challenges of that era.
So what happened then?
Towards the end of the 80s, Pace Petroleum and Victor Gauntlett bought the company, which then led to Ford stepping in.
Ford, okay.
Yeah, first buying 3/4, then eventually 100% of the shares.
And Ford's ownership? Was that good?
Actually, yeah. Our source calls it Aston Martin's most successful era up to that point. Ford brought scale, stability, much needed investment.
Ah, okay.
And that led to some really famous models. The DB7 Volante, the high-performance V8 Vantage, the V12 Vantage, the DB9. Lots of innovation. It really shows what proper corporate backing can do for an iconic brand. Let it flourish.
Absolutely. So fast forward to now, 2025. The constant financial drama seems mostly over.
Largely, yes. Revenue's around £500 million, over 1,000 employees, subsidiaries. The brand seems pretty strong for the future. It's quite a comeback story.
It really is. Survival and reinvention. And a massive part of that modern story, as we touched on, is Bond. James Bond.
The ultimate brand association.
The quintessential Bond car. It actually started in Ian Fleming's 1959 book, Goldfinger Bond, drove a DB3 there.
Ah, interesting.
But yeah, it was the 64 film, Connery, the DB5.
Hmm.
That created movie history. Burned that car into everyone's mind.
For sure. The DB5 is still the iconic Bond car. Appeared in, what, 6 films? Mm. Including that great cameo in Skyfall in 2012. A real nod to the fans.
Yeah.
Even when other car brands were used, you know, often big sponsorship deals, Aston Martin somehow kept its place as the real Bond car. That first screen appearance just gave it this mythic status.
You'd have to say it's a masterclass in co-branding, wouldn't you?
Oh, completely.
Aston Martin gets linked with this suave spy, this huge movie franchise. It's not just a car, it's a lifestyle statement.
Mm.
Sophisticated, powerful, cool.
Exactly, and for the Bond producers, they get maybe the most prestigious British car brand. Adds authenticity, plus probably helps with funding.
Right.
It's totally mutually beneficial. Each one reinforces the other's legend. And for us, the public, we get these amazing cars on screen, aspirational stuff. Everybody wins.
Speaking of amazing cars, the DB10, that was unique, right?
Totally unique. Bespoke design, custom built just for the 2015 film Spectre. Only 10 made, not for sale to the public.
Wow.
It looks sleeker, more streamlined, but still recognizably Aston Martin. It was seen as kind of a hint, a prototype for future road cars, a glimpse into where they were heading.
And the value of something like that would be huge.
Astonishing. One of them, remember, not even road legal, sold for £2.4 million.
£2.4
million. Yep. At a Christie's charity auction, carbon fiber body, carbon ceramic brakes, that big 4.7-liter V8 plush interior, plus, you know, a fingerprint reader for that extra Bond touch. Just pure cinematic and automotive art, a real piece of the Bond legacy.
Okay, so if that kind of exclusivity gets your pulse racing, let's talk about some specific models people actually collect, because Aston Martin really does have something for, well, serious collectors.
For sure.
Like, say, the 1968 Aston Martin DB6 Volante.
Right. That's the convertible version of the DB6, which came after the Bond DB5. They made fewer than 2,000 DB6s total, and only 140 were the Volante convertible. So yeah, super rare, makes it incredibly desirable.
And the price reflects that.
Oh yeah. Estimates our source saw were between £700,000 and £900,000, a proper collector's dream.
And of course, the Bond car itself.
Yeah.
The 1964 Aston Martin DB5, still hugely sought after.
Absolutely. The quintessential Aston for many, the one in the source, was dark blue, not the classic silver, but still expected to fetch 500,000 to 600,000 pounds, probably more given the legend status.
And for racing, boss.
There's the 1960 Aston Martin DB4 4.5-liter lightweight competition saloon, a track car, built specifically to challenge the Italian dominance in motorsport back then.
Did it work?
Won quite a few races, proved Aston's engineering chops, valued a bit lower, 220,000 to 260,000 pounds. Piece of real racing history connects right back to their sporting roots.
So beyond these amazing auction pieces, Aston Martin's appeal today is pretty diverse. We've seen the past. What about the present and future? What are some standout models now?
Okay, yeah. Let's kick off with the Aston Martin DBX. That's their SUV.
Right, the beautiful is relentless one.
Exactly. Modern curves, but still feels like an Aston. Shows they've successfully moved into that key market, but kept their design soul.
Then there's the Aston Martin Vantage. You said it was their most successful model by 2017.
Yeah, individually. It got a relaunch with a Mercedes-AMG V8 turbocharged. Powerful. It's that pure sports car experience core to the brand.
And to the extreme end.
The Aston Martin Valkyrie, the hypercar, designed with Adrian Newey from Red Bull F1.
Power of the gods, wasn't it?
That's the one. Less about selling lots, more about pushing engineering to the absolute limit. A statement piece. Modern automotive history shows what they can do.
What about the Grand Tours? Still important.
Definitely. The Aston Martin DB11, that's been around since 2016. Maybe less overtly sporty than a Vantage, but all those sleek, classic Aston curves are there. Shows they're still refining those luxury long-distance cruisers.
Yeah.
V12, V8, AMR racing version, the Volante convertible.
Lots of options.
Yeah. And finally, let's circle back to the 1977 Aston Martin V8 Vantage, worth mentioning again.
Britain's first supercar.
That's the claim. Raw, powerful, beat the Ferrari Daytona speed, that distinctive bonnet bulge. It wasn't just another car, it was a real statement about British engineering power back then.
What an incredible range. From classics to hypercars, Aston Martin's journey, it really is about resilience, isn't it? Constant innovation and that power of iconic association.
Totally. Nearly wiped out by wars, financial troubles, but became this global symbol of luxury and performance. It's a compelling story.
And what really stands out, I think, is that the appeal isn't just the cars, amazing as they are.
Right. It's that relentless chase for excellence, the ability to adapt, change with the times, new tech, and how it wove itself into pop culture. Bond, obviously. It's a brand that just refuses to fade away.
So thinking about that turbulent history, that constant reinvention while somehow staying true to itself,
Oh.
makes you wonder, doesn't it? How many other luxury brands have managed that kind of dramatic, sustained comeback, keeping that performance edge and that style across generations?
Good question.
What can Aston Martin's journey teach us about staying relevant, staying desired in a world that's always changing? Something for you to think about this week.